Agile Revolution podcast.
That's right.
This is Craig, and I'm here with, introduce yourselves.
Betsy Kaufman.
And Oscar Rodriguez.
Oh, there's a train coming through.
Is that the 115 to Chattanooga or something?
This is how you know that you're on the recording in Charlotte, North Carolina.
In the industrial area of Charlotte. I guess up and coming at this point, right? We're on the verge, so.
We're always on the verge.
Yeah. All right, good. Well, so what brings you here to Charlotte?
Well, I'm speaking at a meetup tonight that you lovely folk have organized. So nice to be talking outside of the Commonwealth and here in the U.S. talking to some nice people in Charlotte. So thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for coming. So you're talking about 40 Agile methods in 40 minutes. How did you come up with that concept? And tell us a little bit about the background on that.
Yeah, so as you guys know, one of the problems, I mean, basically the background was I was pitching something for the Scrum Gathering, and look, I've always used the base elements of Scrum, absolutely nothing wrong with it. 73% of people, you know, or more now,
right,
you know, say that that's their method of choice, but
yeah.
I've always been one of these pragmatic coaches. I've always gone and looked for things elsewhere, so I've always, you know, considered myself to be an Agile coach, not a Scrum coach, not an XP coach, but an Agile coach, because it's this umbrella of principles and values, but most importantly practices, you know, when you're looking for your toolkit. Mm-hmm. And so it just surprised me, particularly in the Scrum community, just how many people hadn't really looked outside of that. So whilst those elements are extremely important, there are so many other places we can go look. And so we just started brainstorming them out. And we probably got about 60 or 70 of these different practices, which were either frameworks in their own right or just practices that can be brought in. So distilled those down to 40, no real rhyme or reason to those 40, but distilled those down. And really it was a talk for people in the Scrum community to say, you know what, there's another 39 things out there that you could potentially go
figure.
Look at.
right.
And so trying to get that into 40 minutes was interesting. In fact, I remembered when I delivered it, Henrik Nyberg, who I'm sure most listeners are aware of, he was at the conference I was presenting it in, and he walked into the back of the room. I was super stoked, because he walked into the back of the room and sat down, and he said to me, oh, good luck with this. And I said, oh, thanks for coming. And he goes, I heard about the talk, and he said, either this is going to be the best thing ever or the biggest train wreck on the planet.
Nice. That's a confidence vote for you. Yeah.
So I was determined to prove him that actually it was going to be good, and he actually said good job at the end. So
nice.
That was good.
Interesting. So you actually brought up a really good comment, because you're like, I'm not a Scrum coach, I'm not a Kanban coach, I'm an Agile coach. Where do you think the Agile coaching world is headed to, or where are we at this point? Because I feel like there's almost a couple of different camps going on out there. Where are you, you know, is most of your training and most of your background in Scrum, or are you actually pragmatic and able to apply the right practices based on the outcomes you're trying to achieve? So what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I'd probably consider myself, if I had to look at what my founding was, it was extreme programming, XP.
Right.
That was where I came from. And I think that probably started the pragmatism, because a lot of people don't realize that extreme programming had that base of iterations and the planning game and this idea of, a product owner, and alongside all the technical practices as well. And I think that got lost a little bit in the
in
the terminology, because Scrum sort of put a little more rigor into that process. It wasn't just there's a planning game, but there is a backlog and there is a cadence to those practices. So when I think, just from coming from that extreme programming background, probably set myself up a little more for, I guess, just being open to defining those. I'm not sure. I think those camps have been here for a long time, though, and in fact, they predate agility as well.
If
you go back to the days of RUP, and even the different project management processes. You know, your PRINCE2, your PMBOK. It's always been one of those things. I think in the Agile world, we've gone through them. I mean, it was Scrum versus XP, and then it was Kanban versus Scrum, and now it's SAFe versus everything else.
Whatever.
And so I think we're always going to have those things. And I think to some respects, that's probably, I mean, there's a bit of healthiness in that.
Right.
Because if it was just one thing, it would be probably a little boring. Like that competition, just like it does in commerce, makes us grow. So I'm glad that there's more than one scaling method out there. I'm glad that there's scaling methods out there. I'm not a big advocate of scaling methods per se, but it's an experiment in order to see how we do that. And so I think it's great that we have those things out there. It's when you drink the Kool-Aid and and just go all in on one without being open to other things, without being that pragmatic right. view, because there's always positives and negatives to things. And the fact is, every, as you guys know, every different organisation you walk into needs a different thing. In fact, every team you walk into has different needs.
Right.
And so sometimes you do need the development practices, and sometimes you need a bit of scaling, and sometimes you're talking about strategy, and sometimes you're just talking about team building.
Yeah. What do you think?
It is kind of interesting how we've lost some of the looking out beyond our own methodology. In fact, it's, you know, I think XP is, that's kind of where I came from as well, being a software engineer. But one of the things that it always strikes me as interesting is, especially when you're talking to folks that were introduced to Scrum as their first methodology, a lot of the stuff that we talk about and we take for granted that go with Scrum practices are actually founded in XP. Right, to your point exactly, there's each of the methodologies are good at different things. What is it that you need at the time?
Hmm.
And it really does need to be a mix and match.
And I think it's interesting that, I mean, XP didn't die. XP just became, in my mind, just the way you write good software. So that to me is success from an agility perspective.
Yeah.
And we're probably at that point with Scrum. I mean, Scrum, mm-hmm. you know, the idea of if you're doing iterative work, you take Kanban out of the equation for a moment, but you know, the idea that we will retrospect on a regular basis, that we will collaborate on a regular basis, the fact that we will have some sort of prioritized backlog and do the most valuable thing first is just common good practice.
Right.
So where the innovation is all the things around the outside of that.
Yeah, cool. So I came from a Scrum background because I actually was a traditional project manager, and somebody said, hey, we want you to become a Scrum Master. Go to Scrum Master training. So I did.
You were a project manager, and you seem like such a nice person,
I know,
too, Betsy.
Yeah.
We don't hold it against her.
Absolutely. But then as I started working with you more, Oscar, I started learning a lot more about the XP practices, and we started infusing some of the Kanban practices. And so we just started to beg, borrow, and steal from the different processes and the practices and the methods to figure out what worked best for our teams. And then as I was writing the Agile Practice Guide, I became more and more exposed to all the other types of frameworks and methods out there. So I've just become learning what else is out there and how do you apply it to the right situation. So it's kind of been a good journey for me. So it's not so bad coming just from Scrum from the beginning. So I'm going to be that camp because I'm probably the majority of folks that are maybe in this Agile, somewhat of this Agile community, or on this Agile journey, if you were not a software developer and exposed to extreme programming.
So in this part of the world, do you think most people, if you were to ask someone just in a team somewhere, would they relate themselves to doing Agile, or would they relate themselves to doing Scrum?
Scrum. Do you think so?
I think that's probably the majority would affiliate more to Scrum than to Agile.
Right. Mm.
Just because of how much these two things have been placed together in the same breath.
Yep.
Yeah. See, that's interesting. In our part of the world, because there was a deliberate attempt to remove, to make it, I guess, more open, there was a deliberate move to call it Agile, which was a hybrid, essentially, of Scrum and XP, and to a certain extent some other things like DSDM, thrown into the mix, adaptive leadership, and a bunch of those early things. So, yeah, I find outside of the Australian New Zealand context that Scrum is considered more to be the thing. Not that we don't have a strong Scrum community in Australia, but when you see people, they talk more about the fact that they want an Agile coach, not a Scrum coach. That an organization wants to go Agile, not Scrum.
Right. Well, I think, especially in the United States, and as it starts to mature, I think they use, like you said, Agile and Scrum synonymously. Sorry.
Close enough.
Together, right? They don't know the difference between Agile or Scrum. And so that's a lot of what we do is when we actually train and coach, we have to explain that Agile is a mindset. There are many different practices and processes and ways to leverage it, but you've got to actually shift the mindset as opposed to just applying SAFe or Scrum or Kanban or XP. To make it work. So I think, you know, we are probably from a open-mindedness of Agile and all the different pieces that make up Agile. When you talk about Agile as a mindset, we're definitely behind where you guys are from Australia, New Zealand, from down under. I think Europe is a little bit more advanced too, and they're thinking when it comes to what is agile and what do we apply for the processes. Would you agree?
None of us come from Europe, so I think we're just. I always,
we could guess.
We could guess. I don't know. I'm thinking because when I think about the IC Agile and us working with IC Agile, I think they've had quite a bit of success because they aren't a framework or a method that's trying to sell or market their materials. It's more of a mindset and thinking about it from that perspective. And I think they've had some good traction in Europe with that approach.
Yeah, I still think. At least my understanding is Scrum is still a big part of the European community.
Okay.
As I said, I can only see what I see from the outside.
Right.
But when people come in, for example, the word iteration manager, which is equivalent to Scrum Master, is a common part of the vocabulary in Australia and New Zealand.
Right.
And anyone who comes from America or New Zealand just looks at us and goes, what the heck is that?
What is iteration manager?
And that's because, I come back to that, was a deliberate attempt to move away from Scrum-specific terms. So call it a daily stand-up, not a daily Scrum. Call it an iteration manager, not a Scrum Master.
Right. Interesting.
What is it, a daily stand-up or a daily Scrum?
It's a daily stand-up, at least in my book. The daily stand-up existed before Scrum codified it,
I would
think.
Yeah, I call it daily stand-up, too.
Okay.
How about you?
It's a definitely daily stand-up, but yeah.
Oh, it's definitely. funny.
Because a daily Scrum only really makes sense in the Scrum context.
Yeah.
And coming from a country that loves rugby and those kind of things. The rugby analogy was, I think the rest of the world was like, oh, this is interesting game of football that people throw the ball backwards to run forwards, and how does
right.
that work?
Right.
Whereas we already had the word Scrum and everybody knew what it meant.
Yeah, we've had to actually educate on what that means and show the picture, and everybody's like, oh, that's what that is. Yep, that's a Scrum. But what's interesting is I was working on some training materials or something, and I actually had a picture of a Scrum, and my older son, who's 13, said, oh, look, they're doing a Scrum. I'm like, how do you know what that is? But because he's been exposed to the game, he understands it. So
Because ESPN?
Yes, probably, more than likely. Something just went in and out of my brain for a second there. I'm trying to think about, I was going to ask you something. Where do you think, Agile 2017, we started talking about this at lunch, but one of the things that I took away from Agile 2017 this year was much, much more mainstream. Agile's becoming very, very mainstream.
Across the chasm.
Yeah, when you start to look at the companies and the folks that were there and the sessions that were very popular, it's the big companies that are saying, yeah, we're going to do Agile, yeah, we're here, we're part of this conference. What are you seeing down under? And then what are you seeing, because you sit on the board of Agile Alliance, kind of what are you seeing more from a worldly perspective?
Yeah, so I sort of had this view, I guess, that it's crossed the chasm for a while now. But I think a little like you, if it wasn't this year, it was certainly last year.
Mm-hmm.
But from the large conference, I'm sensing that same thing as well. It's not just a handful of Agile consultants and coaches who are getting together now to talk about things. It's a whole pile of people who've been either trying to do stuff or been thrust into this community trying to figure it out. Interestingly, though, the real knowledge level, not where people actually say they are, but where the real level is, still surprises me how low some of the things are. I mean, the conferences don't tend to talk about great retrospective techniques anymore, which they did 10 years ago. That was the level we were at. But still, it's still a lot of the same topics. We still haven't sorted some of the key issues, like how to estimate well and how to break work down well and how to report it and how to do good metrics, and all those problems still exist out there, and I think they're the challenges that we have as a community. But I agree with you, it's now not who it used to be, who is doing it in town, and now it's like who's not doing it
who's
in town.
Who's not doing it,
And the companies that are just doing it anyway, and weren't you always doing it this way?
Which
is a lot of the smaller organizations just out of necessity.
Yep,
so
absolutely.
So that's my view. What's the view of Agile like in Charlotte?
Oscar give his feedback on that one.
So Agile in Charlotte. Charlotte's an interesting town in that we primarily, like there's the two largest employers are either financial or government.
Mm-hmm.
And many of these organizations are doing Agile by declaration. They've been told top down, you must do it because everyone else is doing it, mm-hmm. and our bottom line depends on it.
Just go quicker and faster and cheaper. And
unfortunately, that is the message that's been.
Oh, good quality, please.
Maybe that's questionable, maybe. Right?
Yeah, that's a nice to have. It's at the bottom of the backlog.
Cheaper, faster.
Cheaper, faster. In fact, if it all else fails, go cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they fail to achieve cheaper, okay, what roles does Agile tell us we can eliminate?
Mm-hmm.
So let's eliminate the middle managers.
Project managers.
Or the project managers.
Business analysts. We don't need business analysts because there actually are not business analysts in Scrum. You only need a product owner, Scrum Master, and development team.
Or organizations that have been on their journey for a while. We haven't made any progress. We've been doing this Scrum thing. So clearly we should just eliminate the Scrum Masters because that's just overhead.
Yeah.
They're not part of the delivery team.
Right.
So,
And who needs testing because they're not developers either, right?
But it's interesting because there's a lot of positives that have come off the other coast of the U.S. That involve lots of testing and very quick cycles, moving, not just at a 2-week or a 3-week pace, but an hourly pace. And that message gets lost, especially in Charlotte. The defense mechanism that goes up here is, well, we're a regulatory environment.
So you're comparing Charlotte to Silicon Valley? Is that what you really mean by the other coast?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, one of the conversations I have a lot is you can move quickly. If we look at Amazon's journey or Facebook's journey, they didn't start off delivering continuously. But now Amazon delivers once every 12 seconds or so. Facebook is continuous delivery. And while you may not want to go that speed in a regulatory environment, it's actually easier to maintain your regulatory integrity if you are capable of those things. Because that means now that everything has to be automated. Humans are out of the loop, which means it's repeatable. We can actually audit our process and verify we're following the process, and we can codify the process.
Look it up in the dictionary. Regulatory doesn't say see slow.
It just gets equated to it, right?
That's the point. I think we see regulation as being this massive overhead, and we've got to dot the I's and cross the T's. But, I mean, Amazon would be a good example of a company, and even someone like Apple, I guess, is that they're now going into the same places, right? Amazon is moving into banking, as is, and Apple's certainly already in that space. So by definition, they are now regulatory companies, maybe not to the extreme that a large bank or insurance company might be. But I think that excuse is old school risk and audit views, and we have the same problem down the street. In fact, probably even worse to a certain extent, because our large banks, Australia has this banking policy, it's what they call the four pillars policy. So the four large banks are essentially legislated so that we don't have a banking crisis like we had 10 years ago or so with the GFC here, where they're sort of backed by the government so that they essentially can't fall over. That's the sort of the layman's. Mm-hmm. I know someone listening to this in Australia is going, that's not exactly how it works, but that's kind of the rough shot of it.
Right.
So they're guaranteed to make money, right? All four of those large banks will make billions of dollars every quarter and mm-hmm. push it through. And so it was interesting because there was no driver. There's no real disruption because they can't really fail in their current format. Not to say there hasn't been disruptions in that industry, because there are certainly lots of startups, but they're guaranteed to make money. So why would you go?
Why would you innovate? Why would you go do something different?
And so it was only when one of the banks stepped out of line and went, actually, we could take a slightly larger piece of the pie, even if we took 1% extra.
Right.
That equates to a lot of money.
Right.
And so when they stepped out, that then made everybody else run extremely fast behind them.
Right.
So we haven't quite got to this part, but that regulatory thing is a common excuse. But whoever starts to lick that problem, and we're seeing that. I mean, I know there's some large established banks in the UK, for example, that are just starting to to really sort of work through these issues, and some of the smaller banks obviously are doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think we'll go there, but it is a slow moving target.
Yep.
Yeah, and one of the things I did notice when working with audit and compliance groups here in Charlotte was that they actually appreciate the fact that things are documented and automated. Not necessarily, you know, it's not slow, to your point. You know, we were operating on a continuous integration, continuous delivery type model, and to do that, because it was all automated, we could actually document our process, and that's really what they appreciated. Hmm. It's like, oh, you are in compliance, and you can prove it because the machines are doing all the work. And so long as you're, you know, you're source controlling all your automation scripts, they can, you know, they can prove that we're following the compliance rules. It's when they have to dig through all of the manual stuff that's going on that they really get cranky.
Yeah, auditing does not mean, you know, how big is your binder.
Right, here's the binder, go look through it and see if I'm actually in compliance,
yeah,
right?
It's are you following due process? And the nice thing about Scrum or Safe or Kanban is that there is a repeatable process.
Yep.
And sure, we might need to make sure we don't throw the index cards directly into the trash. But yeah, there is a process behind it, and we can show it, and it's repeatable.
Yeah.
So it's actually a lot better than, because I don't know about you guys, I mean, because if it's not agility, and we relate to, you know, what is loosely called, as I do air quotes here, waterfall, end air quotes.
Right.
The reality is, I don't know what your experience is, but every time I go to somewhere that is doing air quotes waterfall, there's no due process. People are just making it up. The only thing that's holding it together is this. Some document has to end up in a binder here at some point, and that's the sign-off process.
Right.
And then a lot of, you know, end process of, you know, sign-offs and right. change controls and
stage
those
gates,
type of things.
Phases like that. That's,
yeah.
that's pretty much what's holding it together. Say, oh yeah, I met the stage gate and I've met these audit controls, is what we're seeing that holds the waterfall together. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's...
Well, then the interesting part becomes, what happens to that binder?
Mm-hmm.
Where does that go?
On the manager's shelf, right? Here you go.
It was quite interesting, speaking of compliance and financial institutions. So I physically had to move one of my teams to a different floor at Bank of America. I'll probably have to edit that out. And as we were moving into the new space, you know, the previous tenants had left all of their stuff behind. And there were binders and binders filled with Y2K processes and compliance documentation that it, we were probably moving now. This was what year are we in now?
We're in 2017. Was it 2014 or 13?
So it probably would have been 2013 or 14 in that range. But we ended up doing a lot of shredding, specifically because there's all this documentation. It's proprietary, so you had to destroy it. But it hadn't gotten used once.
Yeah.
It was put together into the binder, checked off, signed off, and moved on. And I'm sure that a lot of money was spent on all of that.
Well, you never know when we're going to need it for Y3K, right?
Well, the thing is that, you know, people bash on Y2K. I like to think of it as the most successful waterfall project ever. Nothing went wrong, people. It all worked.
We spent 2 years, 3 years, and we were all waiting for that one moment in time when the clock actually struck, and we were all okay.
Nobody... We all did an awesome job. Right, let's move on.
Well, and I don't know if this was as big an issue for y'all in Australia, but one of the
for
bigger...
y'all. Keep going. Okay.
Australia's got their colloquialisms, and I've got mine. Thank you very much, ma'am.
And just like to say g'day, mate, to all our listeners.
Bless your heart. Keep going.
But probably bigger on the in the IT shops was September 9th of 1999. And I don't know if that was as big a deal in Australia, but all of our, we have a lot of the, still a lot of mainframe stuff. It was coded with four digits.
Four nines, yep.
So yeah, we hit four nines, and what's going to happen?
Yeah, well, there's all sorts of those numbers that... that cause havoc, yeah. So, interesting stuff. Hey, one of the things we were talking about over lunch was...
666 is like coming in my head. Okay, next, I'm sorry, let's move on.
Yeah, 66 is still... We'll be gone before we have to worry about the next round of that one. One of the things we were talking about over lunch is... that's a passion topic of mine is the state of coaching.
Yes.
And I'm interested to see what your views are of it, because there's no... there's no code of conduct. There's no...
Right.
So, you know, I know both of you. I know you're both, you know, awesome coaches and awesome what you do. But how does somebody from the outside know that? And more importantly, how do they then compare that to somebody who has had a two-day CSM course and, you know, done 4 weeks of Scrum in a team? So what are you seeing here? What is the leveling of coaches, particularly in Charlotte, which is not a huge town? I mean, it's there's lots of stuff going here, but it's not as big as it's not even
a top. We're not like a New York City or something.
Yeah, it's not a top 10 city, right? It's what's top 25 now?
Maybe it's 11. You know,
it's a beautiful city, by the way, for those who've never been here.
Thank you. We like it. I like it. I've been here for 18, 19 years, so it's a good city. I think it's definitely a challenge here locally in Charlotte, because we are seeing a lot of folks that are doing their Scrum Master training. They may be able to work within a team, you know, typically within a financial organization, so you may have some really bad practices. And then they say, okay, I'm going to declare myself a coach. I'm now a coach. Because there's nothing, like you said, that's actually certifying, or that you can put any rigor around to say, okay, what's a good coach versus a bad coach? So I feel like we are definitely struggling with you know, the gamut of folks who've had experience to folks who haven't had any experience at all. We also struggle a little bit with the rates. So, you know, Scrum Masters, which Scrum Master is a great role, it's a great responsibility, and there is a lot of coaching that goes into when you are a Scrum Master coaching your teams and potentially coaching product owners. But the rate structure can also vary quite a bit, anywhere from $65 an hour to $350 an hour, depending on what we're up against. So, you know, I don't know that I have the answer as to how do you find, you know, how do you actually determine good coaches, you know, from bad. I don't want to use the word bad coaches, but, you know, ones that I've had
less experience.
Bad coach,
right? But ones that have had the experience and have really learned how to navigate the situation or the organization, or decide how to apply the right process or practice based on what we're trying to achieve, focus on outcomes and values. I don't know. What are you saying, Oscar?
Yeah, I don't know that we, to kind of dovetail on that, bad is probably not the right word, but it's lack of experience and breadth of knowledge. So to go back to, you know, the 40 methods in 40 minutes, if you're only exposed to one, you're not going to be able to provide that level of experience, the other wells to tap on. I think one of the biggest problems, especially in Charlotte, and I'm sure this isn't isolated, is that the folks that are doing the talent recruiting aren't necessarily well educated into what is an agile coach.
Right.
And so they latch on to what does exist in the industry, and, you know, Scrum being as popular as it is, okay, if you've got a CSM or a CSPO, that
SPC or that,
yeah, that gets you that first cut.
And the more the better, right?
Right, right. The alphabet soup. No. You're like, you must be absolutely incredible.
And I tend to be on the side, coming from the engineering side, I tend to be a little bit leery of licensing or certification of professions. But then you do end up with the Wild West that we have. I think the PMI, we're starting to see that the Agile, the ACP from the PMI is starting to show up as a requirement in many of the job postings.
Mm-hmm.
And while, you know, this probably start a whole debate as to whether or not PMI ACP is a good thing or not, the one thing it is doing is forcing people to expose themselves to more than just one particular methodology.
Right.
Understand the practices, understand various concepts outside of a methodology context.
Right. Well, and I think I see Agile Expert Certification as well, as it does that. And you have to, you have your Expert Certification, is that right?
I do.
How did you, I don't, you don't have yours. So what's actually involved in that process? Because I'd be curious, and we can come back around to where we think the coaching world is, and how do you actually find experienced coaches versus less experienced coaches. But I am curious about the IC Agile.
Yeah, so if anybody knows anything about the IC Agile process, unlike Scrum or... actually, I haven't set the SPC, so I can't actually talk to that. But unlike Scrum, you don't have to do any assessment to get that certification. So if you sit Agile Fundamentals, if you sit Agile Facilitation, if you sit Agile Coaching, they're just be there for the 3 days of the course. As long as you're there and you participate, then you get the certificate. Okay. And they're quite open on that. It's just a certification to say I had training in this area. I've been exposed to these concepts. That's what that certification means. The expert level takes the next level, though. If you actually want to demonstrate capability in a particular area, and so there's a whole fan in IC Agile, so you can go down the value management, or I think they're called product ownership, now they've just changed it. If you want to go down the project management, the testing, the development, or the coaching angles, once you've gone through those three core subject areas, mm-hmm. you can then go and sit what they call an expert level, which is essentially just a way of demonstrating that you actually have that competency. Mm-hmm. The reason I went, and actually this is the same for me, because I come from a development background, like you, Oscar, it was, for me, the certifications themselves don't really mean anything. They're more of a way to, I guess, force me personally mm-hmm. to learn about something. I mean, even when I was a programmer, I went and did my Java certification. I did my my Microsoft certification, right. more just to expose me to the concepts and I guess, you know, force me to learn some things that perhaps didn't really interest me, or, you know, wasn't going to pick up book up instead of just picking up the cool stuff. And so in the Agile space, it's kind of been the same thing for me, is go and learn a concept and, you know, hey, it happens to come with a certification, that's great, and just put that on LinkedIn and you know, there's your soup and away you go. But the expert level one, to me, I sort of picked up because I actually wanted to prove to myself where my learning was at and perhaps where the deficiency was. So it's a fairly rigorous program to, mm-hmm. to go through that.
Right.
You have to have had a certain level of industry experience in order to sit through it. You need references that that can validate that, and they interview those people and actually ask them,
wow.
from what I can figure out, you know, fairly specific questions, not just a, hey, is he a good guy?
Right.
You know, because of course you're always going to ask people that, yeah. you know, that...
Do you like him?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I wasn't going to go to my worst enemy and go, please reference
please,
me for
please.
This,
right.
this
Absolutely.
Thing, right? So, but they do rigorously ask them questions about, did they do this and did they do that?
Right.
I went through the process. I sort of went through the process. I sat through the Agile Coaching Institute's boot camp.
Oh, did
so
you?
It was a 9-month boot camp to reinforce the learning. And yeah, you're waving your fingers. It's not a cheap exercise. The reason I did that was that there's a cost to go and do the expert level anyway. There's an admin mm-hmm. cost, and they do assessments and things, and that's not, you know, super cheap either.
Right.
And so doing the course, essentially 1/5 of that really covered the mm-hmm. What I would have paid to IC Agile either, and the other sort of, you know, 4/5 was really basically, Craig, get your butt into gear and also give me a deadline and a date and something
right.
to achieve. But it actually became far more than that, because not only did it re-expose me to some of the topics and remind me where I had, you know, perhaps hadn't exercised really well, it also gave me a community of other people who were going through the program at the same time.
Right.
And so I now have a program of coaches, mostly North American based, although there was a couple, there's another Australian and a Kiwi as well on the journey with us. The rest were all North American. But now I've got this community of coaches that are, I guess, kindred spirits to a certain extent, that I always know I can call on. And
right.
so they're the things that, you know, the money can't buy type things that, you know, you sort of have this experience where you run into people. Like, so, you know, you're in my community now, people like you, you're both, because I've worked with you in different areas now.
Right.
But you don't get that just by meeting people at a meetup or a conference necessarily.
Right.
It sort of has to be a next level. And so from a coaching perspective, it can be a very lonely role,
right?
Being a coach, because you're often on your own.
It can be.
And so that was the benefit. So, but to come back to the question, essentially in order then to get through, the boot camp really gave me all the tools I needed, but then you have to go through an assessment. You have to demonstrate coaching experience,
right.
demonstrate you can hold a good coaching conversation, demonstrate mentoring experience, demonstrate training experience, and demonstrate that you will do the right things in a team and
mm-hmm.
And perform that. And the hard thing is you've only got a certain window to do that in. So you have to be able to show coaching expertise in a 10-minute window.
Oh, wow.
Which is very difficult to have a coaching conversation and wrap that up. But that's, I guess, an expertise level.
That just shows you that. Interesting. Yeah. So I think it's funny, because going back to the original question, which was, how do you identify, you know, good coaches versus maybe less experienced coaches. And I know when I'm either working with coaches or I'm interviewing for other coaches to potentially join the client that I'm working at, you know, one, have you done any types of training and actually trained others? And if you have, what is your breadth and depth of those courses? What is your experience with clients? So have you only done team level coaching, or have you actually been able to work with organizations? Have you been in multiple different sectors? So I think that's where the evolution of the coaching is going to start to come out, to say, okay, I've only been a coach maybe in this sector, or I've only worked with, you know, a certain number of teams, or I've never done a lot of training. I think is where you're going to start to see that evolution from maybe a junior coach, for lack of a better word, to maybe a senior or more of a transformational coach.
And then that hasn't even taken into account enterprise coaches, which honestly, I still think the number, I would even say worldwide, people who can really do effective enterprise coaching is low.
Yeah.
It's really low. I mean, plenty of people can hold a conversation perhaps with a C-level executive, but to do it effectively and real change is a hard job.
Well, I think it's definitely an intersection between organizational management and organizational coaching, as well as just interpersonal coaching and leadership coaching. So it's not just being an enterprise agile coach. It's actually looking at the intersection of all the different coaching stances, and I do think the next generation of coaches are going to start getting more and more into those leaderships and interpersonal coaching and how to navigate within an organization. So that's where I see some of these more senior and experienced coaches going towards, is in that kind of that arena. I don't know if you have what your thoughts are, Oscar, or you're looking at me randomly, which is fine.
I often do.
I know.
Oh, well, I guess the question I was going to ask is, can we take this one step a little back? Because I asked you the question about the effectiveness of coaches, but let's actually go back to effective Scrum Masters.
Right.
Because if these people are moving forward and they weren't effective as Scrum Masters or tech leads in the first place, is that where the problem is stemming from?
Maybe.
I think that's an extension of the problem we see just in general corporate life. Is that folks that are good at one particular thing tend to get promoted. And so, you've been a great business analyst, let's make you a Scrum Master now, or a project manager, let's make you a Scrum Master now that we're doing this Agile thing.
Because that's a nice, yeah.
And those skills don't necessarily translate, especially I've seen folks taking tech leads. It's like, okay, what's the next thing? Let's make you a Scrum Master.
Let's make you completely non-technical.
Right. And having to facilitate people, right?
Yeah. Non-technical, no authority, go. And it's the same problem we face in general with promoting people because they're good at what they do is what you're promoting them into, the role you're changing them into, are they going to be well-tooled to excel at that? Mm-hmm. And I think oftentimes it's ignored. So you're a great tech lead, go be a Scrum Master, and the team may actually not show signs of being degraded because they're operating the team the way they've always have, and so they're producing about the same as they've always have, but you're not getting that lift that you would from someone with facilitation and interpersonal skills. It's not to say that tech leads don't have those, but there's definitely a different set of skills that you're good at to excel at the technology aspect of things.
And I think if you go read the Scrum Guide, it's interesting where it sits. The product owner is singled out, I guess, as being a role because it is the customer-facing, business-facing, whatever word you want to use, role. Therefore, it's somebody who's come in or was representing the other side. Mm-hmm. The Scrum Master is a little less defined.
Right.
I mean, it's not well defined. I mean, it says in there, and I'm going to get I won't get the words exactly right, but it talks about that there is one Scrum Master per team and it's a full time role. And listeners to our podcast will have heard me banging on about this for years now. But I think that's sort of where where some of the issue starts, because what worries me is these large organizations that are hiring full-time Scrum Masters, which was never the intent from the Scrum Guide. It was never intended to be a full-time role. It was intended to be someone on the team who was wearing that hat.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
because at the end of the day, we've got to get stuff done. And, and you know, shuffling paper around is not, you know, necessarily, yeah. It's not the person who whose full-time job is to keep the wall up to date and keep managers appraised of what's going on.
Right. Yeah, and I think, you know, I know we've talked about it a little bit, but I think if you do have, if you do hire in Scrum Masters, have them build the team and help get the team up to a level of where they're actually high performing and whatever that means, because that's a, it's a big, you know, what does high performing mean? But where they're able to self-organize and produce working product, right? And then move the Scrum Master on to another team so that, you know, then they should float around as a coach and start working throughout if you are going to have a role that's specific to that, especially in a large organization.
But then call it what it is. It is a coach.
It is a coach. Yep. Absolutely. For sure.
And I think this is the interesting thing where we come from, because we come back to where did we all start. Most of us fell into this, mm-hmm. or we're trying at the grassroots to introduce this,
right.
from so many years back that we've been through the pain of, you know, the old way wasn't working, we were trying to do something different, often far before organizations had got
right.
this buzzword. And now we're in this era where up above is actually just saying, you know, please go do this agile thing and please make it faster and cheaper, is putting pressure down on that, which means that we now have to have far more, you know, agile experts, again,
right.
doing air quotes,
right.
Here in order to facilitate this happening. And it's become a business in its own right, as opposed to what we all started out doing. It was just a way of getting things done.
Right. Changing the way we work. Yep. Yep. But, you know, that's part of the nature of this whole industry and organization. I mean, it's a marketing machine now, and there's a whole...
And we all benefit from it. I mean, let's just be,
like,
really
yeah,
clear,
like,
right?
I'm not going to lie. Yeah. It's been a great, career movement for me, and I've had fun. I've learned a ton with it. But it is becoming a major marketing ploy. And, you know, when you go to conferences and everybody's like, oh, we are SAFe certified, or we are... aligned to this process or this method or this framework. I mean, that's where it's going. And so for me, that's kind of sad. I try to keep an open mind, but I also get a little bit, angered or maybe bitter when I'm like, oh, why did you sell out? Why did you do that? Go back to the principles and the values and what we're trying to actually accomplish here. But
doesn't that to a certain extent just mean that we've been successful, though?
Yeah, I guess.
I mean, just to be really clear for anyone listening who doesn't know,
yeah.
me, I completely agree with everything you said. But on the one hand, that does mean that
right.
it has, that is why
it's
it has crossed
extreme.
The chasm.
Yep, yep.
Well, and I think there's a place for the people that are out there to sell their particular branded methods and techniques. But the thing that angers me the most is when folks that are coaches or are intended to help organizations find their place amongst all of these competing interests, and they themselves are aligned to one particular methodology,
right,
or
right.
they're selling it. Because really our jobs as coaches should be to find the fit for that organization. How do we transform their particular culture? And every company is starting from a different place and they want to go to a different place. So we have to be open to that.
Mm.
And if you're not going to be open to that, at least, you know, express some truth in advertising. It's like, I am a SAFe coach. If you hire me, you will get SAFe. But many folks aren't quite that open with it.
Mm.
Just be open with it.
Mm-hmm.
SAFe as an example, and I tend to bash on them a little bit, but they're a fantastic marketing machine.
Absolutely.
They have a lot of really good ideas. One of their courses is fantastic. They put a lot of effort into it, and it's very clear. I myself am an SPC. If you hire me, I'm likely going to tell you, try and avoid SAFe.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's a good starting point for you, it helps you get to where you need to get to, great. Let's do some of that and see
right,
where we
right.
go.
Just don't make it a destination.
Exactly.
And that's part of the challenge. So I want to ask you a question, because we've had this conversation quite frequently this week, for sure, as well as for the past few years that we've been working together. And you know, you said, meet the organization where they are, right? And I totally agree with that. You've got to meet everybody where they are and go from there. But at what point as a coach do you say, okay, I've done the best that I can, and maybe I need to step away? Because maybe the organization is not ready, and that's maybe a big statement, but it's a topic that you and I have really struggled with, not only this week, but I think in some of our past clients that we've been engaged with. So I'm curious, Oscar, as to what your opinion is, Craig, what your opinion is, because we've all worked with clients that we just, no matter which way we try to skin this cat and we try to help them, they may not be, maybe they're not ready or open to accepting the shift, or I should just stop talking.
What do you have against cats?
I don't like them. You know that.
That I'm going to have to edit out.
or not.
Or not.
Please don't, because I really don't like cats.
For me, meet them where they at, where they're at.
Meet them where they at, girl.
Welcome to Charlotte, North Carolina. Yeehaw.
You have to meet them where they're at when you're starting, because everyone's kind of starting from a different spot. But it's often used as a foil to tell the coach, go slower. Don't push them so hard.
Right.
And while you have to start where they're at, you also need to understand where it is they want to go. And if they're not willing to go down that road,
right,
then it's time to go find someone that will go down that road. Right? Just telling me you want to be agile, great. Where are you today? Okay, we can start here.
Right.
But if you're not willing to take another step, you just want to sit there and complain and pay your coach.
You know, got money. What's your problem?
But doesn't this relate to the sporting analogy? Because if I am a coach of a football team, then our job is to, we're going to get to the World Series or the Super Bowl. That's the thing, isn't
what
it?
What country am I in? Yeah, what sport is being played right now?
We can go to real football and get to the World Cup.
Yeah, or in Australia, let's get to the grand final, right? It's get to the big game. And so, as a coach, you've got a goal that you're heading towards. The problem is what you're alluding to is a lot of coaches join teams. And, you know, they're pumping out stuff now and they still want to pump out stuff later, and, you know, what's the goal?
Right.
And if there is no goal or no vision or no strategy or, you know, something that we're aiming for, then that makes your job as a coach pretty hard to motivate people towards that. And so that I think is the first question, is actually not so much, I mean, there is always is it time to go? Have I given back? But it's very hard to start coaching a team if there's actually no vision or goal.
And
that's the problem with a lot of organizations, is that they're doing it because the people down the street are doing it.
Right.
And if that's your only reason,
right,
that's like saying we want to be a football team because the team down the street are a football team. Mm-hmm. So we'll go get uniforms and then strategy done.
Yeah.
Whereas if our vision is actually to get to the grand final or to get to the Super Bowl, it's a different prospect. So what is the Super Bowl for a team?
And I like that analogy, because if everyone is aligned, if the owner and the general manager are all aligned, then the coaches can make decisions like, this player isn't going to help us get to the big game. We need to replace them.
Right.
Or
right.
This particular playbook is not going to get us there. We need to change our playbook, and then we'll get support. And when the coach doesn't get support, it's time to go play for an owner or a general manager that actually does have that same vision.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great analogy.
So you say when your time is up, it's when perhaps the things you have to give to that team, if I'm a good offensive coach and the team is playing well in offensive, but now they need help in defensive,
right,
where you might need someone who's got that expertise, it's time to bring in a different person to bring that different expertise.
Right.
Yeah. But the problem is that with football coaches, they've still got the same vision, get to the Super Bowl. The problem we have is we take one coach out, so you've just told them, be pragmatic, right? Don't follow any of the things, and the next person comes and says, we should all do Scrum, and so then
right,
we spend the entire time
reworking
how we play football,
right,
as opposed to actually hitting the goal. And so this whole thing about forgetting about agility is not the business, it's just the vehicle to get us there, and we spend so much busy work trying to determine whether we're doing the world's greatest stand-up.
Right.
Who cares?
Yeah. Right.
Well, that's, I think, another interesting... So I'm really digging this. I'm using colloquialisms now, left and right.
What are you doing?
This analogy.
don't go the raw prawn, mate.
Where was I going with that?
You're digging the analogy of sports, I guess, or the Super Bowl, or the World Cup,
so
or...
one coach leaving and another coach coming in with a completely different playbook telling them to do something very different.
Coaching playbooks. We'll put that as a future topic, right? Yeah.
There you go.
Keep going.
Because in American football, that would be referred to as a rebuilding season, right? We've thrown out the previous coach because that clearly wasn't working. We brought in somebody
else.
But
at least they know it's a rebuilding season. That's okay if then you're okay that the team is not going to make the Super Bowl next season.
You've made that decision, right?
And it's no longer faster and cheaper because we're actually okay to go slow.
Right. And then the next question is changing that playbook actually helping the outcome? Or are we just churning?
Hmm.
Right. Oh, outcome. Novel concept. What is the outcome that we're actually going for?
Isn't it just score as many goals as you can? And
it depends on which team you are. It feels like not to change this to a sports podcast, but it very much seems like in American football, and probably in the real football, there are plenty of teams that are completely happy. They don't necessarily have to win the big game or a particular tournament, so long as they're making a lot of money.
Right.
Are we selling a lot of merchandise? Right. Do we have the players that we're going to sell jerseys and we're going to sell seats?
You Americans.
Well, and that's kind of why, not to make it a sports podcast, but that's why I'm not a big fan of the NBA, because I feel like the NBA has gone into that direction. It is all about the money, where it's not so much about the sport and the athleticism, but to bring us back to Agile.
Well, and that's why there's a lot of these companies that will bring in these international names.
Right.
Right. They want...
Craig Smith from Australia.
Like Craig Smith from Australia.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Whose highlight is sitting in a podcast studio next to a train track in Charlotte.
That's awesome!
They get they want the Dean Leffingwells and the...
Jeff Sutherland.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because it's the appearance that we're doing something.
Right, right.
Rather than what
actually
is the outcome.
Doing
if we're looking at outcomes.
Right.
I'd much rather have Craig sitting across from me than Dean. So.
Thank you. That's the nicest thing you've ever said to me.
And half the world just gasped. What? Not that you're not fantastic, Craig. And we shall move on. Next topic.
This is where we need the interlude music.
This podcast is brought to you by
Folgers. Okay, so do we have more to talk about, or should we talk? Should we turn off the recording and talk shop?
I think it's been a great discussion.
This has been fun. So you actually,
I think it just means that we have to come back and do another one at some point.
This will be fun. We should come down under.
I really want to talk. I mean,
so
the playbook topic is something that.
Oh.
Yeah.
Do we want to go down that path right now?
I don't think so, but I think that let's hold that one for a future one. We do have Skype. We can talk about things.
I need a roadmap. I need a roadmap. Don't go there. I'm sorry.
Welcome to Roadmaps. The death of roadmaps.
So what's interesting, did you see that on the On Agile conference schedule for today? So Roman Pichler is talking about roadmaps and how to have better product roadmaps, and the speaker right after him is about death to roadmaps. I don't know exactly, it's a female, and I need to have it all in front of me, but I was like, wow, that's awesome. I really should be actually listening to Roman and then listening to the woman after him to kind of see if they, this is what Agile's about, right?
Death to Agile, long live Agile.
And what's funny is we actually are working with a client and they are super confused because they're trying to figure out what do I do? Because there's so much out there. What do I need to do? Where do I go? What methodologies? What certifications? What governing bodies do I work with? It's a really messy, complicated world. Just not to end it on that note, but it is. And there's a lot of different options, which is a good thing.
Hmm.
But you also have to understand, what are your outcomes and what are you trying to achieve, right?
You need a roadmap.
You need...
I just drove from Atlanta to Charlotte.
Yes.
I needed to know. I had the vision that I was coming to Charlotte.
Right.
I had two ways that I could go from Atlanta to Charlotte, main interstates, that I could have taken that are about the same time. Right. So that was, but that's as much of a roadmap as I need. Right. So I needed to know what my destination was.
Right.
And I had some guidance, right, rather than just driving back roads and hoping that I was heading in the right direction.
Right.
So if you think about in the old days, we had to unfurl the map and unfold it and go, I need to get to this town, this town, this town, this town. Right? But as we move forward, it's like the continuous delivery thing we talk about now. Right? I've now got things that help me get there. Right, I just plugged in the little machine and it said, you know, drive this far for 61 miles and turn right. And you know,
or if you're going to hit traffic, it gives you options. If you go on, if you turn right on this path, then you can maybe get there 10 minutes sooner, or just know there's a police car sitting up ahead.
Yeah, slow down. That's still a roadmap. So
that's true.
But it doesn't need to be a 10-page
playbook.
Or an epic, really, of great detail. I need to have some plan in order to where I'm going. But just be aware that plan is going to change. And so, you can have a 5-year roadmap if you like, but just realize that anything after the next year is going to be increasing. You know, I might decide to go to Washington D.C. or New York from here. It doesn't really matter.
Right.
What was important was that my immediate aim was to get to Charlotte, right? Then my immediate aim was to get to this podcast that we're recording right now, right? And where we go from here, I know what the next couple of days looks like. But after that, what does it matter? And so on your agile roadmap,
you get home at some point, right?
On your agile roadmap, is there's milestones along the way that you want to hit.
Right.
But actually, you know, I know probably what I'm doing up until Christmas time, but actually next year, apart from a few key dates, it's all open.
Yeah.
And it'll figure itself out.
Right.
Cool. Sounds like we need to get on his calendar.
Cool. Think we call that a wrap?
Yes.
I think we should.
So we like to end our podcast with a little saying. We like to say "Viva la Revolution." So given we've kind of been given the old southern thing going on, can you give us the best "Viva la Revolution" in your southern voice?
My southern voice?
I think we need to add a y'all to it.
That probably sounds like it is, right? So so let's go on the count of 3. 1. 2, 3,
Viva la Revolution, y'all.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.